Today is Monday, September 12, 2011. I'm Iqbal Ahmed, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening. The current time is 5:06 and it's time for a full hour of independent news. Today in the news, we'll be bringing you an interview with UBC Professor Paul Beardrey to get some insight into the current state of the economic system. Also, CITR reporter Barton Lemlin caught up with animal rights activist Matt Ellerbeck, a.k.a. Snake Man, to discuss his criticism of the animal trade. We will also be bringing you an interview with Amanda Grondel of Intrepid Pens, Downtown Eastside Reading and Writing Society. All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news. But first, headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. An oil pipeline exploded in a densely populated Nairobi slum today. John Bwakali reports that more than 120 people died in the fire.
Charred bodies, including those of children, lay scattered all over the slum after the raging fire spread, despite heavy morning rains. The fire was caused by a burst oil pipeline that passes near the slum, filled with tin-walled shacks. The oil from the burst pipes then flowed into drainage trenches that meander through the shantytown, causing the fire to spread rapidly. At least 112 people admitted at the Kenyatta National Hospital with severe burns, leading the hospital to immediately declare a disaster. The death toll is expected to rise as many people remain unaccounted for. Kenya's Vice President Kalonzo Musyoka visited the slums.
It's a very difficult environment and we have to commit ourselves to get rid of these slums.
Many of the dead were burnt in their own homes. Others were burnt as they scooped oil from the trenches. Hundreds of slum dwellers were left homeless. John Bwakali, FSRN, Nairobi.
An explosion at a nuclear plant in southern France killed one person and injured four others today. The French nuclear agency says there's been no radioactive leak at the Mercure facility, but officials have cordoned off the area. From Lyon, Nick Martin reports.
The blast at the nuclear plant in the Rhône Valley near the city of Nîmes happened just before midday local time. An oven used to burn contaminated waste from nuclear energy production exploded. The French National Electricity Company, EDF, says the cause is not yet known, but told one news agency it was an industrial accident, not a nuclear one. Officials say the dead worker was killed by the blast and not by any exposure to radiation. They also say none of the injured have been contaminated.
One second, I was having some technical difficulties with...
I'm Nellie. I'm
with the headline news. I'll get that back up and running in 2 seconds.
FSRN, Nairobi.
An explosion at a nuclear plant in southern France killed one person and injured four others today. The French nuclear agency says there's been no radioactive leak at the Mercure facility, but officials have cordoned off the area. From Lyon, Nick Martin reports.
The blast at the nuclear plant in the Rhône Valley near the city of Nîmes happened just before midday local time. An oven used to burn contaminated waste from nuclear energy production exploded. The French National Electricity Company, EDF, says the cause is not yet known, but told one news agency it was an industrial accident, not a nuclear one. Officials say the dead worker was killed by the blast and not by any exposure to radiation. They also say none of the injured have been contaminated. While other EU countries have decided to discontinue their nuclear programs, France has been reinvesting in fourth-generation technology. Currently, 75% of its power is nuclear generated. Following the Fukushima disaster in Japan earlier this year, the EU ordered new safety tests on all nuclear facilities in the bloc. A report on the findings is due later this month. Nick Martin, FSRN, Lyon, France.
Another 92 people have been arrested in Egypt, stemming from Friday's violence at the Israeli embassy. All told, 130 have been detained. As protests grew out of Friday prayers, one faction, hardcore soccer fans known as ultras, led the charge. Despite efforts by activists to prevent violence, the Interior Ministry building was set on fire and Israel's embassy was attacked. The ambassador and his family, along with about 80 staff, were evacuated. More than 1,000 people were injured. Three died. Over the weekend, officials from the military-led government shut down Al Jazeera's media center in Cairo. The network has since resumed broadcast from Qatar. And Egypt's interior minister said today that security forces will use live ammunition to repel future protests at key sites. The UN now says at least 2,600 people have been killed in Syria since protests began there in March. Independent foreign press are barred from the country, so the death toll is impossible to confirm. Reports of state-sponsored killings emerge daily, and the UN cites reliable sources on the ground. The U.S. State Department issued a statement yesterday condemning the killing of Ghayath Mahtar while in Syrian security custody. Mahtar, a prominent human rights activist, had been in hiding for months. He was detained last Tuesday. In Oakland, proceedings began today in a federal civil suit brought by the family of a man who died while in police custody in Eureka, California in 2007. His family claims his death was the result of a severe beating by police. Hannah Veerkamp reports from Arcata.
26-year-old Martin Cotton died in the Humboldt County Jail in 2007. The county coroner's office determined Cotton's death to be a result of blunt force trauma, but did not determine cause. Police were called when Cotton, who was homeless and had a history of mental health issues, was ejected from a shelter following an altercation. Police reports vary but suggest that Cotton was combative. Activists say that law enforcement officials used excessive force, denied medical treatment, and allowed Cotton to die in custody. Verbena Leah of Redwood Curtain Cop Watch, a local organization that documents police violence, cites eyewitness accounts given to the group.
They pepper sprayed him, beat him with batons, they kicked him, slammed his head on the cement over and over, and kept going like a beating frenzy.
In 2008, District Attorney Paul Gallegos declined to prosecute the case, citing insufficient evidence. Cotton's family has filed a civil lawsuit against the Eureka Police Department and Humboldt County Sheriff's Department for wrongful death and civil rights violations. The Eureka Times-Standard reported Saturday that the county had reached a settlement with plaintiffs, but according to the docketing clerk at the courthouse, jury selection was in process this morning and the trial was expected to proceed. Hannah Veerkamp, FSRN, Arcata.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks for 2FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Iqbal Ahmed. And now it's time for your News 101 headlines. In federal news, Prime Minister Stephen Harper addressed Conservative MPs in Ottawa on Thursday and defined that the top Canadian priority is economic growth, noting continued fragility in the world markets. Harper said that circumstances demand that the Conservative Party must listen carefully to Canadians and they must be flexible when necessary. On the other hand, NDP interim leader Nicole Turmel countered, arguing that a sizable majority of Canadians are still living paycheck to paycheck, about 60%, he said. The Conservative caucus is meeting to get ready for the new session of Parliament, which starts September 19th. In local news, Police Chief Jim Chu said in an internal review of the Stanley Cup riots, indicating that the department's response was justified and insisted there was no way to know trouble was brewing in the city's downtown. He said the high police staff based a number of police officers on the streets on experience information they had received. He argued that no one had information that there was going to be a riot and they got surprised by the size of the crowds. The police report is the third review to be released so far and suggests that the city should make changes when it holds large-scale public events to ensure that there is a way to control who attends. Ticketing is one means of guaranteeing entrance for families, controlling capacity, and limiting overflow, the report said. Officials have said that the $563 million BC Place renovation is on time and on budget. The BC Place is set to reopen on September 30th and is going to receive a new name. PAVCO Chairman David Podmore said renovating made more sense than building a new stadium that would have considerably cost you $1.2 billion, he said. He added this is a very solid investment for the community because of its perfectly good structure that is well located and is on rapid transit. It is in the core. The stadium, launched in 1983, will once again be home to the BC Lions and the new tenants, the Vancouver Whitecaps, while trade shows and concerts will fill out its calendar. Before opening day, BC Place will get a new name. Podmore said he is in the very final stages of negotiating for this name. BC's Finance Minister Kevin Falcon said that the British Columbia's deficit has tripled because of the rejection of the HST that is going to mean cuts to government spending in the years ahead. In his latest quarterly report, Minister said scraping the HST will cost the province $2.3 billion over the next 3 years, but the government said it intends to still balance its budget by 2014. Falcon said that this government is going to be run very, very tightly from a fiscal point of view. He added revenues are forecast to increase by an average of 2.8% annually over the next 2 years, while the decision to extinguish the HST is forecast to increase the cumulative loss to more than $2.3 billion by 2013 to 2014. In August, HST was rejected by British Columbians in a province-wide referendum. A major 6.4 magnitude earthquake rumbled Vancouver Island at 12:41 p.m. on Friday, September 9th. The earthquake epicenter occurred about 50 kilometers off the coast of the island, about 300 kilometers west of Vancouver. No injuries were reported and apparently just little damage was done. No tsunami warning was issued. Some specialists have alerted people in the area that they shouldn't be surprised if they feel smaller tremors in the coming weeks. A weekend open house inaugurates the new Hillcrest Center facility in Vancouver's Curling Club, in the same building that was the venue for Vancouver 2010 Olympic Curling Competition. There will now be 8 curling sheets in the facility, a licensed lounge with seating capacity over 200 people, a pro shop, locker rooms, a reading room available for rental in 1,700 square feet at all. After it became popular to the Olympic Games, the expectation is to bring people who are more exposed to sports to play in the new facility in Hillcrest. The curling club hopes to increase membership to 1,500 in the coming 4 years. Finally, Vancouver has been deemed the greenest city in Canada and the second greenest in all of North America, coming just in behind San Francisco, according to the latest Economist Intelligence Unit ranking, an in-house research group for the British magazine The Economist. The British Columbian city is now working on improving the two categories it scored the worst in, waste and water. According to the data, 35% of all Vancouver waste is food. However, a food waste and water conservation program was just released in recent months. The second best ranked city in Canada is Toronto, which was ranked 9th in North America. Well, those are your CITR News 101 headlines for this week. We're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right with you.
Walking alone at night can be scary!
Stop right there, student. Why walk alone when you can call SafeWalk? The safety and comfort of everyone on campus is important. That's why we're here.
SafeWalk is a free, student-run foot patrol service with two-person co-ed teams that will meet you and accompany you anywhere on campus to make sure you get there safely.
Keep an eye out for our bright red reflective jackets and signature foot logo, and let your next walk be with us.
What a huge relief! Now I'll never have to worry about the terrors that could happen when walking through such a big campus at night.
For a walk, you can call 604-822-5355. Use one of our direct line phones located in some of the campus libraries. Use one of the big blue phone booths. Or even ask campus security to contact us.
If you see walkers around campus and you'd like them to accompany you, stop and ask.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. You're hearing us from CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for being with us. And now it's time for your weekday weather forecast with Greg Allen of the UBC Storm Club. Hi, Greg.
It is currently 21 degrees at UBC and sunny. There's a weakening low-pressure system off the coast of BC, and the ridge of high pressure in the region that has been giving us great weather is weakening.
We're having a few technical difficulties with this microphone. We're going to take another quick commercial break, but bear with us. We'll be right back.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Center offers support services to survivors of sexual assault and other forms of violence, as well as their friends, family members, and partners. They are committed to education and the support of students, staff, faculty, and visitors of all genders. They offer counseling, accompaniments, information, and referrals. They also facilitate specialized workshops and training sessions, develop public education campaigns, and hold special events related to anti-violence work. All services are free and confidential. For more information on programs and services or on volunteer opportunities, visit their website, www.ams.ubc.ca/SASC.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. Well, we're going to take one more shot at the weekday weather forecast with Greg Allen. Greg, what does the week have in store for us?
It is currently 21 degrees at UBC and sunny. There's a weakening low-pressure system off the coast of BC, and the ridge of high pressure in the region that has been giving us great weather is weakening. With this, we will see temperatures decreasing through the week with showers by the weekend. Here is your weekday forecast for UBC. Monday evening into overnight, increasing cloudiness with a low of 14 degrees. Tuesday, we will see a high of 20 degrees, partly cloudy skies with partial clearing into the evening and an overnight low of 14. For Wednesday, it will be cloudy with a high of 20 degrees. Thursday will be cloudy with a low of 11 and a high of 19 degrees. For Friday, it will be partly cloudy with a low of 10 and a high of 18 degrees. Saturday will be cloudy with a 60% chance of showers, a low of 10 and a high of 15 degrees. And for Sunday, it will be cloudy with a 60% chance of showers, a low of 10 and a high of 17 degrees. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 19 degrees and a minimum of 11. That's your weather for this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Greg Allen.
Thank you very much for that, Greg Allen. And you can hear the UBC Storm Club forecast here on News 101 every Monday. And Next, we go to a story produced by CITR reporter Martin Lemlin, who caught up with UBC professor Paul Beardrey. Dr. Beardrey is one of the most renowned professors at UBC. He's a professor in economics, and he's a fellow at the Bank of Canada. And it's reading the news, it's very easy to get confused with all the economic jargon that goes on. So hopefully Mr. Beardrey will give you a better idea of what's going on in the world.
The thing that really drew me to this was a couple of weeks ago, I guess the stock exchange had a pretty nasty week. Mm-hmm. And President Obama tried to sort of stabilize it with a presidential address. How does this presidential address stabilize a stock exchange?
Okay, so a stock exchange, first of all, you have to know what determines price of stocks. Mm-hmm. Okay, so stocks are a right on profits of firms.
All right.
Okay, so you have, you know, you're going to be a right to have control on that profit. So it's, everyone has a share, everyone that holds the stocks shares in the profits of the firms and kind of gets to vote and kind of gets money back if they decide to pay dividends back or kind of reinvest it. But it belongs to you. The firm belongs to you, and so that's the profit stream will belong to you as your share. So, but it's looking forward. It's looking at whether there's profits now and in the future, and people have to say, should I buy this or not? How much is this firm worth in the sense of how much will I be, you know, being part in this profits that it'll make? Mm-hmm. And whether it makes a lot of profits in the future depends on whether the economy is doing well and is kind of growing or whether it's contracting. And when things contract, it makes very little profits. When it's going well, it makes lots of profits. So people try to guess what's happening, and sometimes they get nervous, other things have been happening, and they start thinking, well, maybe I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if there's going to be much profit. I'm not going to buy something I don't know what it's worth. And that's what happened a couple weeks ago. People got nervous and didn't know what the things were worth and then didn't want to hold them anymore. So when Obama comes up, he's just trying to tell people, don't be too nervous. It's not like everything's going bad. There's a few things that are going bad. Obviously, they didn't get a great deal on the kind of to attack their deficit problem, but they got something going. You know, one of the rating agencies said, well, they're not doing enough. And that kind of was one piece of getting people worried about things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when Obama was speaking, was basically trying to tell people, like, you know, don't overreact. There's been some bad news, but it's not like, you know, the floor is falling under our feet. It's just, you know, it's not as good. So it's normal that there'd be some readjustment when there's bad news. Mm-hmm. But you have to kind of put it in perspective, and that's what he was trying to do.
When people were thinking that they're not doing enough, what can they do?
Oh, they could have decided to kind of really, you know, either raise taxes in the future to kind of know that. The U.S. problem right now in terms of its deficit problem is they have a little bit of problem right now, but the real problem is in the future. They have an aging population, and that's going to cost a lot, both in terms of Social Security, which is what, you know, retired people get in terms of income, and in terms of Medicare, which is actually like our system here. For they don't have in general a general system like ours for everyone, but they do have it for elderly people. So mm-hmm. once you arrive at 65, you take your retirement, you actually become eligible to be in the kind of public insurance system. As people are getting older, that's going to cost more and more. So they have lots of costs coming out in the future, and they don't have enough revenue because they've been reducing taxes for almost 20 years. And so there's a divergence. They're seeing a lot of expenditures coming up and very little tax revenue. And the markets get nervous about that, is saying, okay, well, that means you're going to be accumulating it. How are you ever going to pay this stuff if you're not going to balance? Mm-hmm. And that's what people were worried about. So they were kind of, and they there could have been a better agreement of saying, we have to attack. We should kind of probably go halfway, increase taxes a bit, reduce some of these benefits, trying to make it go. But both sides hardly wanted to move on either one of those. Is at one end, you had a really strong Republican Party that didn't want to think of any increase in taxes in the future. And, you know, the more Democratic Party didn't want to cut any of these programs in the future. And so you're still with the same problem. They've kind of fixed a little bit of things up in the beginning, but this problem's still there. And it's going to take, you know, it's going to take after the next election before they really attack it. So they could have done more there. They didn't. And that's, that got people nervous because they don't know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know exactly what the path is. Mm-hmm. And then the markets, when you don't know, and like I say, when you're trying to buy things, if you don't know what they're worth, often you say, well, maybe I just won't buy them. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. People don't want to have stocks.
What's the relationship between the tax revenue from government and the shares of private businesses.
Okay, no, the whole thing is they don't know if in the future maybe the businesses will be taxed, maybe they won't be taxed, which maybe the whole government will default. We just don't know anything. So it's kind of, there's like this big unknown in the future, and when you're trying to decide on stocks, you want to be more sure. If it's very unknown, people are very scared of them because it's kind of like it's unknown, so it's risky, and people don't like risk.
So if the entire government's finances are in
turmoil, suppose if they decide
everything else is going to
suffer.
Well,
that's it. And at the same time, for one example, you know, businesses could think, well, there's one possibility. Maybe they'll just tax us all in the future, for example. Mm-hmm. Okay, they'll have to do something, or they might decide to, you know. Just default, and then everything will be in turmoil. Then we won't make profits either. And all these kind of scenarios, there's almost no scenario where they can say, well, it's easy. Yeah, this is really good for our profits in the future because they didn't get a deal. And almost all the scenarios make them look like it's just either nervous or something bad for them. And so that's why.
As for the fluctuations in the markets, that's so the company owners,
the stockholders, could be you if you wanted some. You can buy some if you want some.
Yeah, and those are the ones that dictate the price.
That's right. Every day, it's a free market in the sense that, you know, it's the ones that have it can decide they want to sell them, and other people can buy them, and they try to get, you know, so if you send in and say, I want some today, mm-hmm. you could say, like, say, I don't know, I want to buy Apple today, and, you know, if it's selling at, you know, you can get what they've sold yesterday. Let's say they were selling at $100 a share. Mm-hmm. You might say, I want one share of Apple, but maybe I don't want to pay more than $105. Okay, and so you could call a broker and say, try to get me one for, so then they'll be looking for someone else that has Apple that wants to get rid of it, that's told its broker to kind of try to get rid of it, maybe at, you know, some other price, and then they'll try to get these, people are just buying and selling, and it's between the two that kind of get price that allows that transaction to happen, and that's what the price of the stock is.
So the market itself doesn't trade anything, it facilitates the trading.
Well, the market, I mean, it's trading, like, it's just that we don't go in the pit hole kind of getting it, but it's really, the idea is, let's say, you want some and I have some, it's as if we're kind of getting together, but, you know, we hire someone that does the transaction, but it's really because you want some and I want to sell some that there's really a transaction. The people that are in the pit hole are just, you know, helping the thing happen. Mm-hmm. Okay? And, so that's how it kind of works. But the reality is really it's you wanting to transact with me, and we just go through a broker that kind of helps us do it.
And coming to a number is guesswork, I guess.
Usually it's not quite guesswork. There's like thousands of people like you and thousands of people like me, mm-hmm. and so very quickly, you know, there's someone like, you'll get, you know, kind of somehow these markets actually function. Someone will say, well, I have someone at 100, and then if he sees, you know, there's tons of people that want to buy at that price, they'll say, oh, maybe I'll try a bit higher, and kind of, you know, mm-hmm. so it's not quite guesswork. It tries to figure out, can I get what I want for it? So it's much more like an auction. Guesswork. It's kind of, you know, think about it as much more like an auction where, you know, I put up this thing for sale. So if I want to sell it, I put it up there and then I ask, who wants to pay the most for this? Mm-hmm. And then I look at the price, and if I'm happy with it, I sell it to that person.
And the stock exchanges around the world, they just provide a forum.
That's right. So just to organize that. That's exactly it. Just to organize the share of companies that they can be transacted. Mm-hmm.
What happens during a recession? Like, there must be a certain number that all the stocks need to fall in order to be claimed a recession, right?
No, a recession is not defined on the stock market. The recession is defined on how much we produce, okay?
All right.
Okay, so the stock market could fluctuate. Like, it fluctuated enormously last week. We didn't get a recession. We don't call that a recession. It could be fall by 30%. We wouldn't call it a recession unless actually what we produce in the economy, okay, goes down, and it has to go down by for two quarters. Mm-hmm. So it's what's called a recession is negative growth. So we actually produce less for basically 6 months than what we were producing at the beginning. That's what we call a recession. Mm-hmm. So it's when we turn into a situation where we're actually, you know, hiring less people and producing less.
And if things were to stay the same, that would be fine. It's just,
that's right. And like I said, the stock market can go up and down. If we're producing the same, we don't call it a recession. We just say the market's doing, you know, variations, and that's.
Then why do we look so closely at the stock market?
Because we think the stock market, like I said, what do people on the stock market, what they're looking at is their profits. It's not because they're causing things, but they're kind of seeing, we think things are going to go bad in the real side of the economy, so we think we'll make less profits. So often the stock market falls into anticipation. It kind of is a good predictor of what's going to happen, because this is what the role of people, they want to get out before it gets bad. So they see it. So when you see the stock market fall, it doesn't mean necessarily things will fall, but it means a lot of people in the market thinks things don't look very well. So you shouldn't think about it so much the causality going from the stock market into real things, but more the stock market reflecting what people think is going to happen in the real economy.
Is there too much focus on the stock exchange, do you think, in relation to that?
Well, I mean, it's a big indicator of a lot of information. Like, these are, you know, hundreds of thousands of people transacting and buying and selling and giving you all their little bits of information all together coming into this. And when prices are going up, it means there's a lot of people in the economy. For some reason, they have all these little bits of information. They seem positive on things. So that's a good indicator on average. Now, it does fluctuate way too much in the sense that it's kind of a good indicator. It's not a great indicator. It does a lot of fluctuations, which you don't see it predict anything. And sometimes it does a, you know, it does a good job. So it's in between. Now, that's why we keep an eye on it, because we usually, you know, see that when it really does go down, it usually is because something really is coming, you know, is doing bad. And so we keep an eye on it in the sense that, yeah, it's a pretty good predictor. And
do we know, why is there so much stake in the U.S. economy? Is it just because the sheer size of it?
Yeah, it's just the sheer size of it. It's, just, it's still, like, by far the biggest economy in the world. And so that's just the size. I mean, it's, so when it does badly, that means it affects almost everyone in the world.
Do we know if they're still producing as much?
Right now?
Yeah.
The growth is very slow.
There
is growth, but it's very slow. So it's, you know, we're talking kind of at the rate of maybe 1% a year growth, kind of maybe no more than that. And so we're kind of close. This is why people are talking to be, it could fall into a recession. We're kind of not far from it. We're just growing at a very slow rate. If we go to a little bit further, we'll call it a recession. If we're going a bit faster, we may normally call it recovery. Now we're calling this kind of like almost no recovery, but not falling into recession. Just this very, very slow growth that's happening.
Slow recovery. So they without the stock markets or the stock exchange, it would pretty much just be a free for all to trade, and we would have a certainty of.
No, but I mean, so there's two things about the stock market. So, like I say, to the extent we want a market economy and we want to have firms, okay, there has to be owners. Having the right to buy and sell the ownership of firms makes it even more interesting to buy firms, because you can buy them and knowing this is one way I can save, but the day I don't want it, I can try to sell it to someone else. So we want to have that aspect to help, you know, start up firms, get them working. We want to have a market that you can own them and you can sell them to other people. For the same reason we have it with houses or with anything else. You'd like to be able to buy them and you'd like to be able to sell them. Okay? And the stock market is just the place where, and not even all, you know, some of the stock markets actually aren't a physical arrangement. Some of them are actually on the internet. And you just have to send in your trades, and we have different algorithms for to kind of trying to match the trades. And so the stock market as such is just reflecting this price that right today what people are transacting. As we look, you can look for, you know, I don't know, the market for fish, and you can look for the market for trees, and we have all these markets around. This is the market for firms, and it's much more informative about the overall economy. That's why we look at it.
What's the market for firms?
This is it. The stock market is the
market of firms.
The market for firms. This is you buy shares in companies. Okay, so it's not, you know, mustn't see it as, you know, I don't want to kind of take any kind of no causality, but think about it as a big piece why we look at it a lot is just reflecting a lot of what people think is happening in the economy. And so, you know, especially for people that do news, why newspapers are so interested, they always want to have things first. The first sign, whenever anything's kind of getting a little bit risky or a little bit questioning, the stock market's going to react right away. Because some people are going to say, I should get out before, or I should get in before. And so you know that anything that's happening is probably going to be seen there really kind of very quickly, and that's why we get a lot of attention on it.
Sort of treating it as like a super sensitive
It's a super sensitive gauge of how people are feeling about what's likely to be happening in the future.
Is there anything that we can do individually to help stabilize it, or is it just
it's not clear you want to stabilize it. Okay, it's not like something that, you know, if we decided we could kind of put a law and say the prices of these things are just going to be this forever, okay? But then you'd kill that market of having people. That means You know, if people, because why you have this, sometimes there's new stock putting out. So if a company wants to, you know, start investing in something, mm-hmm. it sells new stock to people. Okay, and you have to determine, well, how do you determine that price? Well, you look at what its stock, you know, how many people want to buy it. And they just, so if you kind of controlled it, you wouldn't get people to be able to invest in new firms. You wouldn't kind of be able to get the whole system running. So we don't necessarily want to stabilize it. We don't want it to vary for stupid things. Mm-hmm. So this is why you get someone like Obama that will come up and to say something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that you don't want it to vary. It's very natural that it varies. For the same reason, you know, if you know the market for fish every day, if you go down to a market, you'll see sometimes they're selling lots of fish, sometimes they're selling less fish. What happened? Well, they got, you know, a good catch, a bad catch, and you wouldn't say, oh, well, let's just stop the price of fish from moving. Because you'd think, well, yeah, what are we going to do? The days they get good catches, we're going to have all this rotten fish on the side because the price can't fall to kind of get it sold. And other times when we have very little fish, how are we going to decide who gets it? Everyone wants it at that. Mm-hmm. So you want the price for fish to vary. Well, it's the same thing for the price for firms, these kind of shares in firms. You just want to let it vary.
Do our interpretations of the fluctuations, do those mean more than...
That's right. What we want to be more careful is actually having journalists that can kind of take away from the aspect that, you know, the stocks might move also just on risk. So this is one of the things that we know. This one of the reasons people stay away from them, just not because they know it's going to go bad or go, just because they're uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to understand, sometimes there's a big fluctuation, and that's exactly what happened like 2 weeks ago. It fell a lot, much more on increased risk. Not because people knew, because people didn't know. It's kind of like, really don't know what's happening anymore. And this kind of gets me nervous. So I just want to get out of things that are risky when I can.
Mm-hmm.
And journalists can make it more clear of kind of saying, okay, let's not kind of get ahead. Let's, you know, what are the pieces of information? How do you, you know, what was it based on? Getting that information out of why it's varying so that it doesn't, because sometimes what you don't want is then it goes down and people say, oh, it really looks bad, so I'm going to sell even more, and it keeps on going down and you just get into this kind of vicious cycle. And what you want is to get people out in the information, and that's exactly what Obama wanted, to say, Let's see on what basis this is done, and let's give you the information, and then hope that with that information things stabilize. And that's pretty much what happened. Things mm-hmm. stabilized, and so we kind of came back to, you know, it's not that everyone's certain, but things aren't kind of like, you know, falling through and kind of being horrible either.
What are the tangible effects when the markets start going down, other than just the uncertainty and the panic?
Well, it's also, so if you're a new firm and wanted to sell some stock, mm-hmm. okay, so kind of to get new investment. Right now, the price you can get for, you know, if you want to do something and get enough money in, you're going to have less people that are going to want to buy, give you that money for the same activity you wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes harder for firms to finance themselves and kind of, but again, it's not, remember, it's not like a causality, it's not the price going down that makes that, it's because people are uncertain, there'll be uncertainty about your firm too, and they won't want to kind of, you know, give you money to invest off anything. So again, this is more reflecting the general feeling that people don't want to take risks in the economy right now and kind of invest projects when the stock prices are low. And that's really the way, you should always think of the stock market as reflecting an underlying issue that people have confidence or optimistic or pessimistic about what's going to happen. It's not that this is causing that optimism and pessimism. It's the reflection.
Right.
It's a reflection. So it's true that when it usually goes down, things start going badly, but it's not because they went down that things go badly. It's because people are being pessimistic and don't want to do things that they both went down and things go badly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the big cause.
All right. That clears things up quite a bit. Is there anything
No, I think that's, if you kind of can absorb a bit of that, that'll kind of help you.
Yeah, that's
part of the way.
Much clearer than when I walked in. Beautiful. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
Paul Beaudry is a professor and a Canadian research chair in macroeconomics here at UBC, and also a fellow of the Bank of Canada. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemelin.
And that's it for our foray into Econ 101, but back to News 101. And next we go to a story also produced by Martin Lemelin with Matt Eckelbeck, a.k.a. Snake Man, talking about his criticism of the animal trade, especially when it deals with snakes.
Thank you very much for being with us. What is it that we're doing to our snake population?
Well, one of the big problems that snakes face is, as most people realize, is a lot of people don't like them. Many individuals harbor a hatred and a fear of snakes. So that greatly diminishes their number of allies and advocates and people who want to help them. And it seems like the few people that do like snakes only have one interest in them, and that's to hoard them in captivity and keep them as captives. And the pet trade has definitely taken notice to that, and now a plethora of different snake species from all around the world are available in Canada and across, you know, other parts of the world as well as pets, and they sort of market snakes as low-maintenance, exotic pets, and nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, snake species, and it varies from species to species, need very specific humidity levels, temperature levels, you know, proper diet, proper habitat setup. They need, you know, a place to hide, to feel secure, and the wild snakes are quite shy and cryptic and secretive. But because the pet trade markets them as these low, you know, maintenance, easy to care for pets, so many of them end up in, you know, neglectful homes and homes that are ill-equipped to take care of them. Another thing that the pet trade does is creates a platform for anyone to walk in off the street, regardless of the fact that they may not be able to properly care for these animals and obtain them. I mean, pet stores and breeders and reptile expos, they don't screen where the animals are going. They're not looking to make sure the animals are going to good homes. They're looking to make money, so the snakes are being exploited and commercialized and treated no different than any other product in any other retail store. So due to that fact, ultimately, you know, many snakes end up, again, in homes that are ill-equipped to meet their needs, and many different animal cruelty groups have documented that 90% of all pet snakes and other reptiles, for that matter, die prematurely due to neglect and improper care. So that's a massive amount of suffering and death created by one trade.
Do you know if that's a national figure or an international figure, the 90%?
I believe it's international. So, every, you know, wherever they've looked at it, that it's pretty much been around that mark that, you know, the large majority of them quickly die off.
Generally speaking, what kind of a lifespan do snakes possess?
You know, in the wild, if they can escape predation and disease, they can live, you know, sometimes 15, 20 years, sometimes more. So they do have quite a large lifespan. So to be dying, you know, within, you know, the first year of their life, sometimes even much less, is a pretty alarming figure.
As far as sort of, I want to say environmental effects, but I don't think that's the right word. What effect is it to have such a large number of snakes just taken out of the wilderness and put into cages in people's homes?
Well, two things I should mention. Number one, snakes are harvested from the wild, from all over the world, and, you know, recovery teams and conservation groups right in Canada, if you research on, you know, our species at risk and snake species that are in decline in our country, you know, often one of the threats listed is the illegal harvest and illegal collection of these species, and that certainly happens to, you know, snakes all around the world. But on top of that, a lot of breeding and captive breeding is done, and so basically what we now have is snake puppy mills. So you have large quantities of snakes being bred for the trade. Now, going back to the wild-caught issue, it's extremely degrading to the natural environment to have any animal harvested in unnatural numbers. I mean, nowadays, especially in Canada, over half of all the snake species listed in the country are listed as a species at risk. And right in BC, you know, you have several snake species which are federally listed as declining, such as, you know, the rubber boa, the sharp-tailed snake, the night snake, northern Pacific rattlesnake, and that goes right across the country. I mean, a lot of our snake species are in decline, and in decline to such a degree that they're listed as threatened or endangered, and that's happening because they have all these unnatural threats that, you know, they're ill-equipped to deal with, such as, you know, being killed on roads and destruction of habitat and climate change. And then to add the illegal collection of snakes on top of that, you know, can really, really be detrimental to the population overall. On the flip, and another way the pet trade is also damaging the, you know, local ecosystems and natural environment is when people do become bored of their pet snakes, they often let them go into the wild. And, it, you know, you can Google snake into Google News almost every day and find a story of, you know, snakes turning up in places where they're not supposed to be, exotic species turning up in areas that they're not native to, you know, pythons and boas and all the rest of it. And that's because people get them as pets. If they do, you know, live, you know, beyond that point where most of them don't, often their owners become bored and burdened with them and then will let them go. And by doing so, they're letting an animal into an ecosystem, and it could have, you know, all sorts of bacteria and pathogens and diseases, which the natural species have no defense against and have never seen. So they can quickly do, you know, horrendous damage to local ecosystems and ecological communities. So the pet trade, aside from being an animal cruelty issue and an animal welfare issue, is also an issue of conservation and environmental degradation.
What are the differences between, like, legal and illegal harvesting of the animals? I guess to get a snake from basically a snake farm, the way you described it, I guess that would be legal. But just walking into the woods, picking up a snake and bringing it home, that doesn't fly.
No, I mean, most of the, and it does differ from province to province, but most of the species in Canada are protected under different, you know, acts and forms of legislation, and federally, the Federal Species at Risk Act, which most snakes are now listed under, including some of the species I mentioned earlier, which are native to BC, it is illegal under that act to harvest animals, take them out of the wild, capture them, kill them, or destroy their critical habitat. However, there is no legislation in place for Canada really around exotic species. There are, you know, municipal laws here and there, but on a federal standpoint, there's really nothing in place. So anyone can, you know, walk into a pet store and buy a pair of anacondas, which, you know, are very common across the pet trade. And if he decides to breed them and then sell them privately or over the internet or, you know, word of mouth, he is free to do so, unless there's a municipal law that states, you know, certain times they'll say you can't have snakes over this amount of feet long or such and such species. But that's so few and far between, and there's a plethora of species available, that it really is easy for, you know, anyone to now start their little breeding operations. And if you go on websites like Kijiji or Craigslist, you'll see a plethora of, you know, different individuals who are now selling snakes and trying to be snake breeders. And again, that just creates another opportunity for anyone to obtain these exotic animals, which should be left in the wild as captives.
What, as far as anacondas specifically, where are their native habitats?
And anacondas are native to South America, and ball pythons, which are one of the most commonly seen snakes in the trade, both in the private trade and you know, commercial pet stores, are from Central Africa. And then you have corn snakes, which are from, you know, parts of the United States. You can see, and all of those are quite common. Boa constrictors are quite common. They're from South America. I've seen carpet pythons quite readily, which are from parts of Australia. So you can see that there's species being imported and bred for this trade from all corners of the world, which are now being found in stores and in people's houses right here in Canada.
Basically, if they're released irresponsibly, they could have detrimental effects on our ecosystem in ways that we really can't even anticipate.
Exactly. And I mean, people don't realize ecosystems are like puzzles, right? Every piece belongs there, and every piece is so closely connected to the next that when you do something harmful to one aspect of the ecosystem, it can have serious ramifications all the way through, you know, the entire web, which includes ourselves. Like, we rely on wetlands as, you know, flood control and fresh water, and, you know, there's so many things that people don't realize that we depend on from the natural world, and by doing so and degrading it, it, you know, affects many, many, many species, including the individual snakes. I mean, if you let an anaconda or a boa constrictor or a ball python go somewhere in Canada, I mean, it might live out the summer, right? But the odds are it's going to die. And again, if someone finds it, the snake is usually killed out of fear or often destroyed, because if it is found, people don't know what to do with it. I mean, zoos, and that's a big misconception. A lot of people will buy these pet snakes, like boas and pythons and anacondas, Condas, and know full well that they are going to get big, and then just think that when the time comes that they're unable to manage the animal, they'll just call their local zoo, and the zoo will be happy to take it. But, you know, zoos do not take animals from the private sector or from, you know, people's personal collections. I mean, if they did, they would be overrun with animals that they would, you know, not be able to accommodate.
And there is legislation in place to protect some of these snakes. Is it a matter that the laws aren't being respected by the citizens, or that they're not being enforced?
Well, you know, animal cruelty laws and conservation laws are often poorly enforced, and again, for anything to be done, it has to be reported, right? I mean, many people who encounter snakes in rural environments, camping, hiking, cottaging, etc., that don't like them and, you know, might think they're dangerous or scary, might go over and persecute that snake, and if it is a protected species, which most are, or a species at risk, it would be illegal to do so, but, you know, if it's not reported, what can be done? And, who, you know, a lot of people, it might not even occur to them that, you know, hurting a snake is, you know, against the law. So a lot of times, you know, it just never gets reported or and then enforced.
So in your opinion, what needs to be done in order to help curb this issue? Is it a matter of bringing in stricter and harsher regulations, or just a little bit more education for the public?
I think it's a mixture. I mean, number one, you know, some people who buy snakes from pet stores or breeders may not really understand. I mean, you know, there are people out there who do take good care of their animals, and I fully acknowledge that. There's people who probably love their snakes and take very good care of them, but even those individuals who are the minority are still giving their money to a trade which is causing all these problems for snakes. Essentially, if you buy a snake, you're just directly funding their suffering and ultimately their death. So, you know, it is a part of it is education to let people know, if you really care about these animals, if you really find them fascinating and interesting, do you really want to hand, you know, a handful of money over and help support this industry financially, which is ultimately just hurting snakes? Secondly, I think there should be some legislation in place that, you know, bans these animals, and it gets brought up every time a python or, you know, exotic snake gets, you know, turns up in a place that it shouldn't, and, you know, people get all up in arms about it. So, I mean, it would be great if these animals, you know, the import was banned and the sale. In Ontario, they're talking about doing what's called the Exotic Species Act, I believe. And it's not in place yet, but it's being proposed, and it would make anyone who wanted to have any of these animals, they would have to apply for a special permit or license to, you know, ensure that they can meet the needs of this animal, and that not only for the animal's sake, but, you know, for the environment and things as well, so they're not going to have snakes going loose. And I think, you know, ultimately, I think they shouldn't be pets at all, but at least a licensing system would be certainly miles ahead of what's in place right now. And the reason I say they shouldn't be pets at all, people should understand, you know, if you have a dog or a cat, you know, having that animal and giving it companionship really does improve that animal's quality of life. People will spend all day at work and then come home and their pets will be there to greet them and, you know, jump up out of excitement and purr and cuddle them and give them kisses and want to play. Those animals show very visually body language that lets them know that they do enjoy that companionship and being around their owners and spending time with them. Snakes, you know, naturally, their natural behaviors are not social animals. I have rescued snakes from, you know, the most deplorable homes and seen some very, very cruel, horrific stuff, but I don't delude myself. The snakes don't love me. They're not thankful for it. You know, when I come home, they don't enjoy seeing me, and so the average person really doesn't need to have a python in their living room. You know, having that snake is not doing anything to improve its quality of life or benefiting it in any way. It's really only done for selfish reasons, and I, in my opinion anyway, I don't really think that's enough to justify this trade continuing.
So as things stands right now, if I wanted to get an anaconda, I wouldn't need to get a special permit or anything like that?
No, unless where you're from there is a municipal law in place, and I mean, I admittedly don't know every law for every little county and district out there, but federally speaking, yes. I mean, if you walk into a pet store, you should be able to find an anaconda, a boa, a python, all sorts of, you know, exotic snakes from all corners of the world, and you can hand them over money, and it's yours.
This might be a little harshly specific, but do you have any ideas about the numbers of like the population of snakes and how it's been affected in maybe the last 10 years or so?
It is extremely hard to get numbers. I mean, monitoring snake populations in the wild is incredibly difficult. A lot of snake species are listed as data deficient, which means we basically don't know enough about them to really make a call on the population, whether it's stable, increasing, decreasing. It's ironic that so many people are afraid of snakes because the reality is they're extremely shy, secretive animals that try to avoid detection. And because of those traits, it does make monitoring their populations difficult. Similarly, when asked how many snakes enter the pet trade, you know, some estimates say everything from hundreds of thousands up to the millions. Again, it's so poorly regulated that, you know, exact figures are hard to come up with. And I think those two facts, that we don't know how much is in the trade and we don't really have a great idea about wild populations, really all we can say is this species is listed as not at risk and this one is, shows you that there's so much about these animals that we don't know. And I think, you know, any, you know, reputable biologist or zoologist, or ecologist would, you know, be the first to say there's so much about reptiles and snakes and the natural world that we don't understand, we don't know yet. So if given that, should we really